During the Vietnam War, my guest, Lady Borton, worked in an American Friends Service Committee hospital in South Vietnam. She was in an area that experienced some of the heaviest fighting of the war. She returned to Southeast Asia after the war ended, this time as a health administrator for a refugee camp off the coast of Malaysia. Borton wrote about her experiences with Vietnamese boat people in a book called Sensing the Enemy. Last year, Lady Borton returned to Vietnam. She was the first American journalist allowed to live with a family in a village. She recorded interviews with Vietnamese peasant women who played crucial roles in the Viet Cong victory. Borton produced a radio documentary for the Soundprint series. Here's an excerpt from an interview with a Vietnamese woman who spent 16 years in prison, 8 months of that time in tiger cages, which she describes in this translation.
If you could visit Con Son Island, you would see the 60 tiger cages. A grill and catwalk ran across the top so the guards could look down on us to watch us. Each cage was 1.2 meters wide, 2 meters long, 5 sisters in that space. We lay 2 on the bottom, 3 on top. I had epileptic seizures from so many beatings, and then I would bleed. There was a recess in the floor with a wooden bucket inside for our excrements. For 8 months, I had to lie on top of that hole so that my blood would not mess the cage. Up above us on the catwalk, the guards kept a bucket of lime. If we sisters would sing or speak to each other, the guards on the catwalk threw lime down on us. But we had to sing and ask about each other. We had to ask after each other's health. We had to have some communication. Otherwise, we would surely die.
That was an excerpt from Lady Borton's documentary titled After Sorrow, which was broadcast on the Soundprint series on public radio. Lady Borton now lives on a farm in Ohio. She drives a school bus for retarded children, and she also writes for Harper's, Ms. Magazine, and the New York Times. When we spoke, she had just returned from her fourth visit to Vietnam. I asked her what draws her back there.
It's part of my life now. It's a major theme. And I think that's happened to a lot of people who were there. People who were in the service, American service, who were there and maybe pushed it out of their minds for 15 or 20 years, but realizing that it's a recurrent theme. And if they don't go back there in their physical body, they go back there in mind. And I've been fortunate that I go back in my physical body so that, you know, I can take my mind with me and re-enter the experience.
Is it in any way like returning to an old wound? Are there wounds for you there?
Not anymore, I think. There's certainly some residual guilt or, you know, in terms of what happened and what my role as an American citizen, a taxpaying citizen, was in it. There's certainly feelings about that. But I think for myself, I've been able to move beyond that. When I was in this refugee camp in 1980, that was with boat people, mm-hmm. people who left Vietnam. That was a healing experience for me. I think that was my reentry and reliving it in a peacetime setting, so that now as I go back, that really has happened for me.
You talk about the memories, and I assume that like soldiers, you have flashbacks because you were there during the war. I mean, the war was going on around you as you worked in this particular hospital.
I do. I think we all have flashbacks. And I like to make that point. I think we all have the same experience. Maybe if we can just tie it to our own lives, mm-hmm. that there's some intense experience that we've all had. We've lost a child, we lost a parent, we've lost a lover, whatever it is. And sometimes when you least expect it, an image of that jumps out at you. It happens to me in supermarkets quite regularly. For instance, when I go into we have Kroger's at home, whatever you have here, A&P or Acme or whatever it is, and there's this barrage of shells of choices, and you reach for a head of broccoli and your hand gets sprayed and all these kinds of things. Well, there are parts of the world where there isn't enough to eat, mm-hmm. and it just sometimes will suddenly hit me, and I have very specific images. So it's not a general memory, but it's a specific memory of a refugee camp where I see kids dying, and that image is suddenly before my mind, and it's I describe it as having two movie cameras in your head, and suddenly one of them moves in.
And you say one is in black and white and one is in color.
Color. Yeah, you know, the color. It's like old movies and and modern movies. The old one's in black and white, the memory's in black and white, and the modern one is right up front in Technicolor. And suddenly it shifts, and you're looking at this old movie. It's like your body is in one place, but your thinking is somewhere else. And I think we've all had that. We've all had that happen to us.
I would think, too, that with experiences that you've had, that squaring those experiences with how we live, and I realize that you've made some very specific choices about how you're going to live, and it's probably different. I know you don't have a television, and you live very simply on purpose. But squaring, I suppose, on one hand, the plenty that we live with and the lack of so much that's in the rest of the world, how you square those things.
And I think, you know, we can't. I think that's what's happened for me, that I know that I can't. Other people look at my life and they think I live simply. I look at it and see that I live in great luxury. I always have plenty to eat. I have a car. I have a house, you know, nice house in the country. I have a job I love. Oh, that's luxury. Mm. That's luxury in this life. So that, you know, it depends where your point of view is on that. In terms of some people in America, it's perhaps very rustic and simple. In terms of the rest of the world, it's incredible to have all that. When we're talking about PTSD, post-traumatic stress, and flashbacks, the difference, I think everybody has flashbacks. The difference is when that second camera takes over and you don't realize it's happening, right? So that you lose what's reality. We all have that time when happens to me at parties, for instance. Everybody's having a good time and you're not.
I know that feeling.
Everybody has that feeling at some point because something else is going on inside of you that has nothing to do with the party. Right? What happens and when you're in a danger zone is when that takes over and you lose track of what the real situation is right now. Then you're in serious trouble.
In one of your articles, I think it was a Hers column in the New York Times, you talk about an ambush of feelings. And I thought that was an ambush of memories, an interesting choice of words about how a flashback feels.
Mm-hmm. Zap.
As if someone jumped out at you.
Got you when you least expected. And then you learn, too. I think for each of us, there are certain things that trigger that. You know, that trigger certain kinds of memories. You know, if you've lost a loved one or a child or whatever, you either surround yourself with certain images or you purposely don't surround yourself. There's a way we protect ourselves. And we all do that in our lives.
And one way that you do that is you avoid mirrors.
I avoid mirrors, yeah. and the reason I do that, there's a little story behind that. In 83, and I did this actually most recent trip, visited a hospital in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, where they've had any number of patients, women. It's a women's gynecological hospital for the southern part of Vietnam. So they've dealt with a lot of women who come in with Agent Orange. Results of that, a lot of cancer of the uterus and a lot of deformed children. And just going into the specimen room with wall-to-wall crocs and having the doctor open the shutters and the light coming in and the sort of catching in the liquid and whatever it was surrounding these babies. And they're just incredible distortions of the human body, forearms and the navel in the middle of the forehead.
And they're preserved in jars.
And they're preserved, yeah, because they're doing research on what the effects of this Agent Orange are. And we have the same thing happen in this country, but we're not talking about it. But they are talking about it and researching it. And what happened to me was when they opened the windows and the light came in, it bounced off of these jars and sort of threw them up as mirrors, you know, the way that that can happen in a glass of liquid, so that I suddenly, as I was looking at these very strange human forms, I was looking at my own face, in which I am perfectly normal, unscathed. And that juxtaposition of images, it's like every time I look in a mirror, that's what I see, that's what I think of, that's what it reminds me of. And I don't need to be reminded all the time of that. It's related enough in my consciousness that I don't need it.
And you carefully avoid mirrors for that reason.
I don't mind, you know, I look at my face in the morning. I have one over my kitchen sink where I brush my teeth. So, of course, I comb my hair occasionally. But I don't like to sit in a restaurant when there's a mirror behind the other person and try and, you know, have lunch with you and be looking at myself in a mirror because I get distracted.
Yeah.
Right? I'm trying to relate to you and I'm seeing these other images.
Do you feel at all, because of your particular experiences in and with the Vietnam War, somehow separate from the rest of us who didn't. And I know that many people who fought there have told me about that. I mean, that they'll say, you could never understand because you've never been there. You don't know what that horror was about. And I think oftentimes feel very alienated from the rest of us.
I don't feel alienated now, but I think at times that I did. I do feel different. I feel like there is part of me that just thinks and responds very differently, and that's where much of it comes from. But I'm also aware there's a very large community of people who've had that, and that community is much more in touch with each other than it has been in the past.
Do you feel part of that community?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that I have a kind of instant rapport with a veteran. Because I know, now I didn't carry a gun and I wasn't in combat, but I saw enough of it, and I was out walking around in the hinterland unarmed, so I could walk there quite freely. And, you know, as I look now, that was an interesting experience of meeting with the first women who were in that piece. Right? Now, those were Viet Cong, people in the south of Vietnam. And as I talked with them, I became aware of how often during the war I had waltzed myself right into their midst.
And not known it?
And known it but not known it. I had always said during the war I could talk myself out of arrest. But what I realized during that trip was how often I had done just that. Because they would always come up, these women would come up and start asking questions. And you could always sort of tell who they were because the ones who were Viet Cong would start to make a little speech about how wonderful the Americans were and how, now these are the ones
and
fighting.
And watch you carefully. Perhaps.
And watch, right, and watch me carefully. And they would just protest too much. You know, they would just, how wonderful we were and coming with our arms and saving them from the terrible running lackey dog communists and so on. And you knew right away they were putting on. But I was a lot younger then, and I think I just was a little whimsical about it. And this time around, I realized. And I said something to them, and they said, oh, yes, you know. We would have asked you lots of questions, and we would have decided you were okay.
You have a book. Your book is called Sensing the Enemy. I mean, is that part of what you're talking about being in their midst and knowing and not knowing?
Yeah, and also that in that quality of war, what the enemy is, where I think it really is inside of us. That if I had projected, as they talked to me, if I had projected a kind of anger and intolerance of them, I would have been snatched up and something would have happened to me. But they would ask a lot of questions. You know, I would talk about the kind of work we did and why we did it. And I worked with the Quakers, American Friends Service Committee, which is headquartered here, Philadelphia. And we assisted Vietnamese on all the different sides of the war, and I would always make that point. Well, then, you know, how do you fight with a person who's not taking a side?
One of the women that you talk to talks about lost footprints and referring, I guess, to the many people who've died in all their wars. And there was a woman in particular whose husband died, and she couldn't find the body. And her pain over that, about trying to find out where he was and not knowing. And it did remind me, I think, of the way many families in this country whose husbands, fathers, children were lost in that war. They're missing in action and have never been found. And the kind of lost footprints that we have in this country that really parallels that woman's experience.
And that we do have a large number of them. But for them, and for us, we're talking about 2,400, roughly. For them, it's 100,000 or whatever. Yeah. I mean, lots and lots of people are muttit. You just hear that word all the time, muttit, muttit, lost. Because who knows where they died? Bombing raids or crossfire, refugees who, you know, ran from their homes and mass graves, all kinds of things, both sides. And for them, there's a tremendous emphasis in their culture on family and ancestors' graves and tending the graves so that you don't just bury a person, but you do that, the mourning goes for 100 days and repeated visits to the grave. Then a year later, any celebration day, the family visits the grave, family altars in every house. Communism has not eradicated any of these sorts of things. Religion is very strong in Vietnam, and this tending of ancestors is very strong, meaning your immediate ancestors, your parents and grandparents. And so, and to do that, you must go to the actual grave site, and you nurture the spirit, feed the spirit, literally taking food and incense and so on. And if you can't go to the actual site, then you can't properly tend that person's grave, so that there are wandering souls, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And I think that, and for them, they don't have that sense that Americans have, that if that person is missing, possibly that little string of hope that American families hang on to, that that person might still be alive. I think there's unfortunately, no reality to
that. I wanted to ask you about that.
I think there isn't a prayer or a chance. Mm-hmm. I'm positive the Vietnamese are not harboring any live people. The country is very densely populated, and you know, I'm not that tall, but I stand a foot taller than the tallest Vietnamese. Any American just stands right out. You know, I'm like a magnet anywhere I go because I'm fair-skinned and tall and curly-haired and everything they're not. So that I think there's not a prayer of that, unfortunately. But you don't have that sense of a death if you don't go through the ceremony of it.
And in a sense, the soul is lost, and the living family feels, I suppose, a kind of groundlessness as well.
Yeah, that you can't you can't finish the relationship because there's going to be that strand of hope that you have to hang on to.
The women that you talk to speak so intimately about their lives and about their experience. Was there any hesitation to talk with you, a tall, curly-headed American woman who came with a microphone and a tape recorder and was asking them questions? Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit. I speak Vietnamese. That makes a big difference. I had a Vietnamese friend traveling with me, so that there was, and she was wonderful. I couldn't have done it without her. So that gave a kind of permission to it. And then I was just really interested, and the Vietnamese friend was also interested and got very involved in it. And I let her take over a large part of it. One of the things that people said to me consistently was that they had never told those stories before.
To anybody?
To anybody. Anybody. Now, the woman, for instance, who was in the tiger cages, when she spoke, and they would sort of take me places and often not tell me what was happening. They forget to tell me who I was going to go talk with. And they took me into this, the women's union building, and I just knew I was going there. Well, there were all sorts of people there. I couldn't figure out what was happening. Well, then I realized that all these other women knew that she was going to come tell her story, and they came to listen. So there was a whole crowd of people sitting around listening because they'd never heard her tell it. And they kept saying this to me, well, I've never told this story before, I never told this. And I tried to figure out how could this be so? And then I realized that one thing is that they're moving ahead, so they're not thinking about the past. Right? It's too painful, it's over now, whatever, they're moving ahead. The other thing is that why should I tell you my story, you know, if I've lost my three children and my house was burned twice and I was in prison three different times, 2 years each time, because you lost your husband and saw your daughter raped and then massacred and your house was burned five times. Every time you rebuilt your thatch house, down it went again. And you were in prison and tortured. And you were in the tiger cages. Well, what else is new?
Yeah.
So that they all those people I talked with were arrested and they were all tortured. And that happened on both sides. Right? Our pilots in the northern part of Vietnam were also tortured. So it's not one side or the other. Both sides did that. But your story isn't unique then. And they haven't had the kind of need to process that our veterans have had, for instance, where they need to be telling those stories to each other because they've been surrounded by each other. They've continued in that community working together, and our veterans have not known where the people they worked with were. They don't know where their platoon members went off to. They rotated in singly and they came out alone, so that you lost your supportive community, whereas these people were all working with each other and they continue to do so.
My guest is Lady Borton. She worked in a hospital in South Vietnam during the war. She's returned to Vietnam a few times since that war. First, she worked with refugees, and more recently, she interviewed women who had played crucial roles in the Viet Cong victory. Lady Borton produced a radio documentary of these interviews, which was broadcast on the Soundprint series on public radio. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Lady Borton is my guest, and she's been to Vietnam 4 times, and we're talking about some of the people that she met there, and specifically some of the women that she interviewed who fought on the side of the North Vietnamese. The woman that was in the tiger cages, she was there for 8 or 9 months, and she'd been imprisoned about 16 years.
16 years in prison.
How do you think women prisoners cared for each other? And I think she talks about singing and I suppose those moments when you need to make some kind of very deep personal contact. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I'm asking is how you think women are imprisoned together and how might, that might differ from the way men are. Maybe even the rituals that women need to survive.
As she talks about it, it was a tremendously caring and tending community. And I think that's not an idealized thing. I think it was essential. Mm. The only way, and the same kinds of tales come out of the Holocaust in World War II, that the people who survived were the ones who tended someone else. And actually, you know, when you're right on the edge of starvation, that kind of tending energy is an emotional energy that can surpass starvation. There were women who got down to 18 pounds, one woman. Now, that's not even bones. 18 pounds.
And
survived. Well, of course, she didn't walk out of prison. But now, that's not this fourth child. But because the human spirit can evidently surmount that. But without that kind of spirit, and they realized that they couldn't do it. And we have to realize that this is a people who had a whole background in how to survive. How to live underneath the ground. And this most recent trip that I'm just back from, I met and talked with a number of women who had been in the tunnels of Cu Chi, which was the base area outside of Saigon. And they had underground 300 kilometers of tunnels, so that's, 180 miles. And I went in some of those tunnels. They're about 2 feet high. You crawl through and all around through underground. And they, you know, they lived there for years and years and years, popping up above ground, diving down under, and that had been going on during the French time.
It's amazing to think that kind of determination and how the United States really either, I suppose, didn't understand the kind of determination of the Vietnamese. I wonder whether it was a kind of arrogance on our part or just a kind of ignorance on our part about who these people were and what their country meant to them.
Yes, I think so. I think it's what we didn't see. We thought that whatever we would bring, because we tend to think we're the best in the world, whatever we might bring will be the best and everybody will want it. And it is true that the Vietnamese would like to have the material goods that our lifestyle represents. But the tie to one's home is something we don't understand it in this country because we're an immigrant society. We're all boat people in this society. We've all been here relatively recently, and I'm from an old Quaker family. So, but it's recent in terms of Vietnamese history. 300 years is nothing. Yeah. It's again a blip on the TV screen. But they've been in that area for generations and generations. We in this country move every 3 years. Statistically, that's true. So. You don't have a tie to the place where you are. You're not related, for the most part, in this country now. We're not related to everybody up and down the block. Used to be that way, but it's true where I live out in Ohio. Everybody at my hollow is related to everybody else, and there's that kind of tie to the land there that's very fierce. But we don't have it, and they do. The sense of their homeland is it's in the music. To me, that's so haunting. Mm-hmm. And the Vietnamese talk about that quality in their music because it's an expression of their fierce and sad love of their homeland, their constant need to have their homeland, which they've only had since 1975. Again, kind of separate from whatever side any of us were on in that conflict. The country is now Vietnam. Owned and occupied by Vietnam. Certainly ties to the Soviet Union, but the Soviets do not run the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big difference.
Were you tempted to want to adopt every parentless child there and bring them
back? Oh, sure.
And how did you resist? I mean, obviously you can, but...
Yeah, I don't. My approach is what I try and do is deal more with... I deal with groups, institutions, and I think that's where that kind of energy goes. that I do something for, I mentioned the hospital that with the where they're dealing with Agent Orange, and they have so many young women coming in with cancer of the uterus. I'm talking about 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
That's not usually when you see that happen. So I send medical journals there. Well, that's some way of touching that group of people. Because there isn't, you know, the need is so great that you have to figure some way where you can help someone who's trying to affect that society.
Do you feel you understand why people fight wars?
I think in this particular one, I certainly understand. I understand their determination, and I understand that one of the things that I see is that there's no way we could ever have won, which is the big question everybody debates. You know, we could have
If
only we had done this, I think there is no if only. You know, we dropped more bombs than had ever been dropped in history. What happened? You know, we still didn't win because they were so decentralized that there's no way we could have totally disrupted the society. You can't disrupt a subsistence society. We were thinking in the way that in this country, all you have to do is bomb Con Edison, knock out the electrical system, and the country shuts down. That's it.
Yeah.
The traffic lights stop, the gas pumps stop, the computers stop, the elevators stop, the world stops. But that's not true there because the electricity never works anyhow. So, you're on your bicycle. What difference does it make? And so you just can't. And when people are so tied to the land and they're working with their hands, that's what they're going to keep doing. And short of killing everyone, they would have kept at it.
Well, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time, and there's so much more I wanted to talk with you about, but we're going to have to stop. Thank you. Lady Borden's radio documentary on the women of Vietnam is entitled After Sorrow. She's one of the few American journalists allowed to speak with villagers in Vietnam. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.